Blog Talk Radio.
Lock your mind. See you rising, wanna stop your crime. Sell the drugs they sold to us and call it drug bust. Grab their money, double product, then they lock you up, it's fucked up. They stand their ground, you better bow on yours and tough luck. We start rebelling cause they failed us, man, enough's enough. We bring a pistol, they got kids. We got rocks, they got grenades. Waving tanks all in your face. Ah. Look at what you made. You're trying to send the mud, then get mad when we decayed and enraged. We played this old game since we was raised. Until we load the cartridge, blow that dust up in their face. Ah. Yeah, this shit is bad, dog. Under five blacks, sending got a black ball. Yeah, this shit is fucked up. No more cry, time to ride if they act up. Guns up with that vest on and they pumped up and they ready to go a few jumps up in that lid. Fuck what you did, bruh. Your wife is thinking your kids crying. Heard what they said? Toss your shit off on that float with that pistol up on your head. Them fuck boys running straight to your stash, like in that closet, under that bed. Grabbing your kids and copping your bread. Ain't re-up, niggas ain't find shit, Lord. Somebody sell them, these niggas know too much. Point out some sucker niggas ducking, probably know too much. Now wifey caught a kiss, your baby fucking scarred. Trash in your house, these niggas claim it as they fucking job. Nah, asking questions, keep your calm, cause these sucker ass niggas hating hard.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. Welcome to another night of YBE Radio. We have JB on the line. I have my lovely co-hosts, Shalice and Keith. We're happy to have you guys today. We have some amazing guests. We're going to get into that shortly where my co-hosts at. Let me have y'all chime in for a minute.
Yo, peace everybody. This is Keith, aka Mac, however you know me as. Peace to everybody. Hope everybody doing good.
Do I have you on the line as well?
Yeah, I'm here. Peace, everybody.
Awesome. So tonight we're going to get into an amazing show. We have two amazing young gentlemen. We'll get into a deeper intro a little bit later, but we have an amazing playwright and an amazing activist. We're going to get into some hot topics first. So there's a lot of things been going on in the last couple of weeks that we haven't been on air, but I want to start off with this Macklemore song, White Privilege. Have you guys heard this song, or did you guys get a chance to listen to this song yet?
I have not gotten a chance to listen to the song yet. I know I said I would listen to it before the show, but as I told you before, I don't listen to white rappers. You know, it's not because they are white. It's usually because they cannot rap. So I just... They're clear. I know what I like to listen to. But I've seen it floating around on some of the blogs that I frequent, and I see a lot of talk about it. He came at Iggy and Miley, Iggy Azalea and Miley Cyrus, you know, two of the biggest cultural appropriators. So, but then you have him, who I never listened to the song. But it's the fact that, in a way, he too is appropriating our culture, but he decides to call them out about it. Is it because they did it in a different way? I mean, it's all cultural appropriation. Like, you still taking something that does not belong to you, remixing it, and presenting it as something new. So that's just, you know, my opinion about him deciding to speak on that in any way. Okay, I'm done.
For me, okay, well, for me, I just felt like listening to it, and what I think is very interesting is, for me, Macklemore always seems to have a message that goes with the calls at the time. And for someone that has kind of watched, I watch a lot of radio interviews and just kind of into hip-hop news and articles, and I've just followed him in these interviews and watched him talk about privilege, watch him kind of become comrades with Iggy Azalea and their plight, you know, against white people trying to break into the scene, and, oh, the rough times that they're having. And I just think it's funny now that he writes a track where he is basically talking about his white privilege. And, I mean, it's great to, I guess, it's great to see a white person accept the fact that white privilege exists. But it is funny to me, coming from Macklemore, when last year when Your White Privilege got you the Best Hip Hop Award and you try to play Kendrick, you wouldn't think about that shit. And I also think it's interesting that now white people are like, oh, we didn't know that this existed, and now Macklemore wrote a song and we understood it existed, which to me also, again, shows your white privilege, because we've been rapping and singing and all types of shit about that shit, and no one likes to acknowledge us, at least the white people. So I just thought it was interesting, you know, wanted to hear your thoughts.
I mean, but that just ties into the whole, you know, thing about, and I'm not going to take that too much time, but that just ties into the whole thing about the Oscars, because we have continuously, since film has existed, like, the black community has consistently delivered stellar performances, not only just in black Hollywood, but, you know, as a whole, when you just look at cinema. So the fact that that's another industry where it's not just music, it's in that industry too, where you have this whole controversy over, you know, who actually, why are we begging them to accept us, why are we begging them to give us accolades. But in some ways, we deserve it because we have been consistently performing, consistently entertaining, and it's the fact that they take our culture and remix it and repackage it to make it something that white culture can accept, and that is given awards. To me, that's insulting.
And I
yeah.
agree 1,000%.
I agree, and I didn't get a chance to listen to the song either. But I just don't like him. One, let me clarify, I just don't like him as an artist. Like, it has nothing to do with his color. Like, I just don't think he's that good. I think that he has great people around him, but that doesn't necessarily make me like him. I will say I appreciate that he went back and got some of the hip-hop OGs and the hip-hop legends when he got Melly Mel and them on a record. That's dope. But he always comes across like he's trying too hard. Like, I think the reason why Eminem made it in, you know, the way he did was because, and not to say that, you know, all white people got to do this, because there's plenty of white people that have made it throughout hip-hop or who have been influential in hip-hop. So I'm not saying it's just him. But with him specifically, he embraced being himself, and he embraced what he did that we didn't do, you know what I'm saying? And I think Macklemore tried that, but he's too apologetic for it. Or he's too apologetic to be like, hey, guys, I know this is messed up, guys, sorry, you know. And it's like, yo, you know what I'm saying? So that's what makes me be like, yo, like, chill, like, who are you? Like, I understand you trying mm-hmm. to get us to like you, but who are you, my dude? Like, I mean,
just,
you know, Eminem let us know. So I just,
yeah,
I don't really
feel
rock
like
with him. I just don't rock with him.
Yeah, I just feel it's real unauthentic. Like, you know, when Eminem rap, like, Eminem wasn't rapping to us about world issues. Like, I just think it's crazy. Like, okay, first it was, you know, the thrift shop. You want the broke people to, you know, rock with you because you was broke and, you know, you had to go to the thrift shop, so you made it cool. Gotcha. Okay. Then it was the gay marriage thing, and then you were like, my mom thought I was gay because I was a little girly, but I'm not, so I wrote a song about it. Now, in this new song, which is very interesting, and I advise you as well as everyone else to listen to it, it goes into kind of this dialogue piece where now there is a white mom talking to him about her son and how he has influenced her son. So for me, it's just like he just be looking for something to pull at your heartstrings. And white America be eating that shit up. Like, oh, when that nigga, you know, got on there with the gays and all, you know, all the gays, parading across the awards, it was like phenomenal. It's a great thing. It's just like, for me, it's like he just hopping onto whatever cause will give him money. And I just think it's interesting. Like, is any of these proceeds going to go to, like, Black Lives Matter or to Flint or to these causes that your white privilege is not helping with? Like, I don't know. But we can move on from that.
Probably not, because people who I mean, I wouldn't even expect that of him. And you know why I don't expect some of that? Because you can't even expect that of the influential people in our community. You know, I've seen some standing up, like, I think the game, he just donated $500,000 to the Flint water effort. And I've seen a lot of local leaders, shout out to What's Up African. Also, it's a couple other people that I have noticed who are in their local areas organizing efforts to send water bottles and other supplies to Flint, Michigan. So I just wanted to mention that really quickly.
Yes, I agree. And it is, actually has been a couple rappers, so I appreciate that. And along with these, like, dumbass challenges that we got going on, I see rappers challenging other people or other rappers to donate. So I think with, I believe it was with Meek and 50, and they were going back and forth, and Meek was like, I just donated to Flint. How about you stop talking to me and do the same type shit? So, you know, I can respect that, although I still think Meek is a fucking nigga, but we can talk about that another day. But, you know, I can respect them stepping up to do those things or whatever. And just to piggyback off of Shalee, shout out to What's Up African, King Leon, and Rez the Ruler out there making big moves, giving out big, big bottles of water. So that's amazing. I'm happy that we've had them on our show. So I'm going to kind of move on to the next topic, which will kind of bring on also our first guest, that I would like to bring in as an actor and playwright. But what are your thoughts on the Oscars, guys? Because for me, I feel like these awards are not for us, so I don't know why we keep expecting awards for them. Like, they were never made to include us. Like, we have to be included forcefully or because, oh, well, we should because it's the right thing to do, but they were never made for us, so I don't know why people are so surprised.
Okay, but if we're going to say that, then I think it matters because, as I said before, we've continuously entertained the world globally. This is what we have done, you know, on so many levels in every area of the arts. And I think that what they are saying is the system has to be different in order for the types of movies that we want to see to be included. You know, it's not the traditional, a lot of the films that blacks, that our community supports, like Straight Outta Compton, you know, things like that, are not movies that a movie critic would necessarily say is an amazing film, a quote-unquote Oscar-worthy film. So I think what they want to do is change the conversation about what is Oscar-worthy. Is it something that's meaningful and that has great content that people connect with, or is it just directorial shots? Is it all about, you know, the technical aspect? I think that's the conversation that we need to have about why there aren't more people on the Oscar, more people of color on the Oscar committee. That's what they're trying to bring to the forefront, and I support that.
Oh, man,
I agree.
I feel like that's cool, but I still don't think that we should care as much. If I feel like we put that same energy into caring about our award shows, then we would care less about what their award shows rate or rank us. Because it's like they don't give two shits. Excuse my language. I'm sorry. They don't care about if they win a BET award. They don't care if they win an Image Award. They don't care if they win none of that. But we don't either. So until we care about that.
That's right there. What's the standard of the BET Awards, and what's the standard of an NAACP Image Award, and who are they? Who is our community? Who are we awarding? Because I know that who was nominated for Best Female Rap Artist? I think it was like Nicki Minaj, the girl Tink, a couple other people who haven't released a single in like a year or two.
Right.
So when you talk about our award shows, I think a lot of celebrities don't support our award shows because of just the quality of people who are being nominated. In recent years, it has improved, but I watch award shows, so I know that The people who are being nominated, like, they don't deserve those awards on any level.
I agree. Go ahead, my bad.
I'm sorry, I was going to say I would have to agree and kind of disagree. Because at the same time, half the people that we are nominating are the same people that are nominated in the same category for the White Awards. Let's be true. It won no rappers, female rappers out for a long time. So, therefore, it was a lot of award shows that made up people to put in there with Nicki. However, at the same token, it's just, for me, I feel like it's the weight that the Grammys hold. The Grammys, in our minds, because of how old they are and the legacy that they are, no matter how masterfully a BET award show could be done, it'll never be a Grammy. So until I think we as artists see that and put value into that, because as long as we don't value it, no one's going to want to make it better. As soon as we started saying, you know what, we're going to stop watching that stuff and we're going to focus on these black shows and all this shit happening, the caliber of the shows that we've been watching have gotten much better in the last year or two, because now the interest has grown. But I think we have to show the interest, tell what we like and what we don't like, and put our energy towards that, because the Grammys, like I say, it don't give a fuck about us. I mean, it's black people in the government. That don't mean that the government is going to be changed today. I mean, I don't think that'll change the rhetoric, personally.
But that's what I was kind of going to get at. Like, if we did focus our energy there, then people would be pressured into making something better, and it will bring more focus. But like, when you see a Beyonce and a Jay-Z, they will never show up to an award show unless they're being presented with some great award, but they'll be front row center at any award show dealing with Oscar, Grammy, which is okay, rightfully so, I get it. But that's what I'm saying. Like, the artists themselves will not take time out and show up. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, it could be better if they showed up, if the best artists showed out. So this is my opinion. Like, I don't think that getting people on the Oscar board, because now it's always going to be seen, even if it changes a little bit in the next couple of years, it'll be seen as just a reaction. It's not something that generally was going to happen or something that matriculated itself. It's just a reaction of something that people were like, we're going to shut them up for a little while. But they're going to go right back to their old ways. And Leo DiCaprio is going to still be nominated for everything and not win. And, you know, some random dude like Sylvester Stallone is going to win an award for something they don't need. So, yeah.
Right, and then the one nigga in the movie that made the movie hot. But let's go. Let me have you go ahead to the next topic, Keith, because we could talk about that all damn day.
Yeah. I guess we're going to introduce our first guest, a brother by the name of Sean Arnold. I have had the pleasure to work alongside of this brother for quite a while now, and he's very talented, playwright, actor, in my mind, an activist, very smart and intellectual person, somebody who I have discussions with all the time, and just a great all-around person. So check him out. Is it Michonne? Are you there? Hello?
Give me one second. He is here. Hold on. Let me bring him in. All right, Michonne, you on the line? Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
How you doing, brother?
Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, bro?
All right. So we're here. I didn't get to say the name of the play that I saw, but it was Power Stokely. It was very, very phenomenal. So first I want to say, you know, congratulations on that. It was definitely inspiring. Even brought my pops out for that one, and we had a good time. So, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about the play and all of that.
Okay. Well, I was listening to you. I wanted to touch on some of those things that y'all were speaking about. I'll probably do that later time as we go on with the show. But, my name is Michonne LeBron. Brother said Arnold, and that's the name I was born with. But a few years ago, I decided to just drop that name because of religious reasons and just doing history on myself, being a black person or African-American person here in the United States. and feeling that that name as Arnold is only thing it reminds me of is being connected to an individual through a bill of sale as opposed to through blood. And I'd rather go ahead and do some investigating and, you know, take your African-American DNA test and be connected with someone, regardless of what the percentage is, 20%, 1%, some people say, to someone that I have that 1% connection through blood, heredity, opposed to someone through a bill of sale. And so I usually don't, people still usually call me that, and I don't, you know, people have been known as that for over 40 years. But as time continues on, I just go by the first and middle name that was given to me by my parents. I've been writing since 1983. That's interesting, man. When you say it like that, that's like forever. I've been writing since 83. I was 10 years old. And I began writing short stories and began writing poetry. I didn't take writing seriously, though, until about 87, 88. And I was, you know, of course, during the golden age of hip-hop. I started off writing as a rapper, doing that with my cousin, with friends of mine. And as I continued to do that, I started to just get back into poetry and really focusing on that and really studying that. And I think everyone's favorite poet, you know, in high school, you know, Edgar Allan Poe and all those different people like that. I remember I used to hear about Nikki Giovanni, and I remember Omari Baraka and his writings as a playwright and poet. And during all that time, you know, I would act, school plays, church plays, different things like that. And I decided at some point that, man, it would be interesting if I could write my own material.
Right.
Because you would audition for other people and, you know that you would be a good fit for that role, but, you know, they pass up on you. Maybe you're not tall enough, maybe you're too short, or you're not short enough, or you know what I mean, you're not white enough, you know, or you're too black,
right?
Or you're not black enough, you know what I mean. And I should probably go ahead and entertain this idea of writing my own material.
So what was the name? Do you remember the name of your first play that you written?
Well, I'll tell you, the first play that I wrote was when I performed for people and people paid to come see it was actually a play called Thug, The Hate U Gave, the Tupac Shakur story, which was first produced by Ground Up and Rising. That's a theater company in Miami. And man, it was a great experience. I went back and I revisited that play. I rewrote it, and it became Right to Remain Tupac Shakur, because the play was based off of Brother Tupac Shakur, and I had it set with him being inside of Clinton Correctional Institution. I put him in solitary confinement and basically have him on stage working out the reasons why he was there, what road he was going to choose once he got out. And you also saw flashbacks of him with Jada, and he always used to talk about dreams that he would have. And so I brought about a dream on the stage, and this is a solo show, you know, so I was able to play all these different characters and bring all these different characters to life. And the response was just amazing. Miami, I performed it down there many times. I went to New York and performed a snippet of it. I performed it in D.C., and I even went to London and performed it off West End, which is like they're off-Broadway there, and the people just loved it. And after that, that's when I said, you know what, you know, I think I got a handle of this thing. And that's when I decided to write the show that you saw, Power of Stokely Carmichael, which we did this past summer. It was our world
premiere. Yeah, that was phenomenal.
Premiere.
That was phenomenal.
Yeah, it was the whole thing was phenomenal, and because not just what we wrote, but the cast and crew that I the crew that I had, not the cat, the cast was myself, but the crew that I had was just amazing. All ladies, you know, that show together. The director, Jennifer Knight, did a just awesome job. We had Momo, my stage manager, and we had a lighting designer and sound and, you know, and a video person, Anika Harden, she did that. So we had mostly all ladies working on this thing. Not all white ladies, it was multicultural. We had white, Asian, black, you know. So it just really having that, all those different people together to put together that show on the spirit of freedom, justice, and equality, which is what Black Power is all about, you know, and what Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture is all about, just really helped lift that show to the heights where, I mean, it just touched everybody, man. I was really shocked to see how it just really impacted people, you know. And for some folks, they had never heard about Brother Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture. Some said, I think I know of them. I tell you, when they came and saw that show, they knew. And they were just, some told me they even went out and bought books, you know, the Black Power book, bought his autobiography, you know, bought the new biography about him called Stokely. You know, so, I mean, it really just awakened in people about what we're dealing with now. I mean, the timing couldn't be better with all that's going on right now. You got the Black Lives Matter movement going on and people really seeing what's happening as far as these race soldiers going out here and shooting down unarmed individuals and people, which has been going on for forever, I might add. It's just now that we have technology and everybody has a camera now, you know.
Right.
Flip that camera and you can film it.
Well, just jumping back into the play for a second, because, as you know, I'm an artist myself, and I've had to perform. I performed a song me and my brother had called I Can't Breathe. That was in direct reflection of what was going on at the time. It was around Eric Gardner's death. And I had to perform it in front of a room of white people, like alone.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was not a single black person in there other than myself and my boy. And I came to the play and I know I had like a little moment of, man, like, you know, I'm about to really do this. And I did it.
Right.
And I feel like I took it to a whole nother level because of it. Do you feel that, like, what is the feeling you have when, because the things you're saying in the play is powerful and from everything to the background effects that you recorded yourself, to being on stage actually saying the words live, like, how does it feel being in a room full of basically people that you're speaking about, you know what I'm saying? Even though it might not be them per se, them and their ancestry. How does it make you feel?
It makes me feel that I'm you know, I'm on my post. I'm doing my job. My assignment is to do that. That's my assignment as an artist. My assignment as an artist is to speak truth to power. And, you know, and one thing I've noticed is that these plays, such as Stokely, such as Tupac, the majority of my audience to date has been, we were calculating this, 94 to 95% Caucasian, white Americans, that come out to see my shows. And on the regular, most of my fans are white. Now, you say, well, damn, how the hell? Only thing I can tell you is that when you're speaking truth, how can you deny truth? I mean, how can you turn away from the truth? I mean, the truth is attractive. You know? And when you put it, and when you put it out there, like that,
you know, just very, just we put it up very beautifully. You know, we didn't put the meal in a dirty trash can. We put it on a nice, you know, on a nice porcelain plate for you. And man, I tell you, that's oh man, that's delicious. And the people will eat it up. And so, you know, and that's why I say, you know, more people understand what's going on here. People may not want to say anything. People may want to try to turn away from it, but you can't. The truth is the truth. And that's what the theater is for. We go, theater goers go see a play because they want something real. If they don't want anything real, they'll just go ahead and turn on the television, you know what I mean, and be fed that garbage, you know what I mean, you know, tuning in and just completely dropping out. But most people, they come to the theater so they can be fed, so they can get that medicine that they need, so they can be in touch with a semblance of reality that can, and that they can probably walk away with something to help fix them or fix their world. Or fix the world at large. You know what I mean? They can walk away with something and say, okay, I'm going to use that. That's the reason why I go to the theater. And that's one of the reasons why I'm not a fan of musicals. Unless it's a musical that I'm like, damn, okay, shit, all right, I'm going to take something from that. Other than that, I don't want to come there and see you kick up your legs and smile at me, hella, and run around like a fool. I can watch reality shows, you know, was the Housewives of Atlanta. I can watch that, you know what I mean? Just to watch, you know, that type of foolishness, you know. But when I come to the theater, I want to walk away with something that's like, dang, okay, that was meant for my soul, you know. So when the people are out there, they know. Whites know. They ain't stupid. Yeah, don't ever let somebody white like, oh, really? Why do you? No, they know. They know. Yeah, the images that they saw. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. No, you know. Your great grandfather possibly told you about how they lynched that boy, and you were probably disgusted with your great grandfather for telling you that story. And he showed you the pictures of the souvenirs of them cutting off his hands while his neck was still in the noose. You know, I remember those images that they show you, and you can find these on YouTube, when they showed the Klan, I believe it was the 1920s, walking down Pennsylvania Avenue in D.C. And it wasn't like 10, like now you got like 10 or 20. There were hundreds and not thousands walking down Pennsylvania Avenue, proud as I don't know what. And I even believe that one of the people that was leading the crowd was some gentleman dressed up like Uncle Sam. Okay, and they were all holding these American flags. Thousands. And I remember KRS-One said this one time, whatever happened to all those robes? You understand what I'm saying? Whatever happened to those robes? Those robes are in somebody's basement. Those robes are still in somebody's attic. Those robes are in someone's chest and or trunk. And hey, let me show you. Let me show you. Yeah, this is... with your granddad. You understand what I'm saying? So they know. So when they're looking at that play, it's not, it may be shocking for some of y'all, but they're like, shit, you putting it out there like that? Yes, I'm trying to give medicine to try to help heal you and your sick mind and our sick mind as well. You know, because that's the horror of white supremacy. Is the enemy of both black and white people. It keeps both groups from rising to their full potential. I heard a wise man say that, the truth. You know, so it keeps you on both people on a savage level, animalistic level. You know, that's why we do those plays. So that's why when I'm out there with the brother, he's saying I'm not performing, and all the folks looking at me, I feel good. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you do, brother. You should, because it's an amazing experience. Did either one of you ladies have a question for Brother Mashawn?
Well, I do have a question. PC, brother. My name is Shalice. I'm one of the co-hosts.
All right. Nice piece.
I've just been so quiet because I've just been soaking up, you know, all this passion. And you've been saying some really powerful things. And I haven't seen the play, but I've heard amazing things, and I can just hear you invoking that spirit of our ancestor, you know, through the passion that you have about not only that play, but our people in general and the situation that we're in. So my question is, what is the personal impact that playing someone with such a powerful spirit as our ancestor, Kwame Ture, what has that impact on you? Because I know that you've spoken about how it impacted others, but what has it personally done for you?
Well, I'll tell you, it made me, a friend of mine, when I decided to do this, he convinced me. He told me that he was watching some footage of Brother Kwame Ture, Stoker Carmichael, and he called me. And he said, man, you know who you look like? I was like, well, I don't know who you're talking about. He said, man, you look like Kwame Ture, man. He's like, you, not only do you look like him, you sound like him. I was like, I sound like, he was like, when you, because I'll do lectures too. He said, man, when you're doing your lecture, you sound like this dude. He said, I put his video on, one of these old black and white videos. His daughter is about 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And he said, Eli, who is that? And she said, oh, that's Michonne. I was like, what? He's like, man, I think you need to do something with this brother. So I, you know, decided to do my research, and I did my research, and the impact on me has been something of a feeling of being an instrument. And I remember Michael Jackson saying he feels like he's an instrument of nature. And I really do feel that, at least with these two brothers, Brother Tupac, when I played him, and Brother Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture, I believe that I've been used as a, as some type of antenna, you know, or conduit, or you know, allowing these spirits, allowing these ancestors to speak through me to us, you know, about what needs to be done, what the time is, and what needs to be done. You know, and that makes, I'm humbled by that. And, you know, when I always take an inventory of myself when I do these performances. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, and that's nothing really to be proud of. But it has to be so close to perfect. It has to be perfect, you know, in my mind. That I, you know, I'll take my time and I'll meditate before I get on that stage. And I tell you, when I'm out there, it's not me anymore. It truly is that individual. I can honestly say that now at this point in the game, I can say that it's not me. It is that spirit. It is. It's that ancestor coming back and speaking through me to us. And I'll tell anybody that, you know, when we continue to perform this play, to pay attention, you know, because that's the brother. The brother is talking to us. He's telling us that the stuff that we're involved in, the stuff that we are being preoccupied with, that's not what needs, that doesn't need the focus. The focus right now is Black Power. It truly is that. Not even necessarily Black Lives Matter. Because you continue to focus on Black Lives Matter. You know, when you say, and this is not to disrespect anyone who's down for the Black Lives Matter cause, because I applaud my people, anything that they're trying to do to bring about freedom, justice, and equality. So let me just make that just off rip, as they say. And let me put that out there. Anything that non-white people are trying to do to bring about freedom, justice, and equality, I applaud. With that being said, though, to tell them or to try to remind others that Black Lives Matter, if I'm on top, I don't give a damn. You know what I'm saying? So what? Black Lives Matter? Okay, well, whatever. Nigga, get over there. You stay over there in that neighborhood and I'll let you know when to come out. If I want you to come out, it depends on how I feel. Okay, now you can sit over there with your sign, and you can interrupt some of the folks I put in here in office. You can get in and stand in front of them. That's fine. Just when you're done, hop yourself back in that leased out Lexus you got, haul tail it back to your hood, and you sit there and wait for further instructions. That's the mind of the white supremacists. Because when you say Black Lives Matter, it's almost a sign of it's almost like a begging. It's almost like, can't you see I matter? It's almost like an abusive woman with a man, you know, I matter.
Mm-hmm.
Woman, you better get your ass back in there and make that steak. I don't give a damn about what you matter. My steak matters. Now get in there and hurry up and make it. Hurry up. And she does it. And she goes over there and she makes that steak. That's what we're doing. See? Black power is what's needed. Black power, us coming together and being for real about coming together, sitting down, working out differences amongst us, and truly being united. We've tried everything else but that. We really have. And I mean real unity. I don't mean just, okay, a couple of groups coming together. No, I mean, I'm talking about real unity, all of us being on the same page, and then making something happen for ourselves, not unifying and going down there and holding up signs begging for people to change their mind and their hearts, because that's not going to happen. That we need to face facts. That's not going to happen. The only person that's going to save us is us. That's what Stokely was trying to say, Brother Kwame Ture was trying to say, Brother Malcolm, who's the father of the Black Power movement, really Elijah Muhammad, but I'm not going to touch that. But, but that's what all these brothers, the Honorable Messiah Marcus Garvey, was saying the same thing. It's about our unity. Mm-hmm. We've been hearing
hearing this.
We're the only people that act like no great folks. God has never brought any great people among us to tell us what to do. Why? Because we're not interested truly in that.
Mm-hmm.
Brother Neely Fuller says Black people can't stand each other. This is the reason why we continue to be like the hamster on a wheel. We keep doing the same thing. And we're crazy. We keep doing the same thing over and over and over, expecting a different result. And that's why Brother Kwame Ture came back through this play to try to remind you yet again that you need to be unified.
I agree 100%. And
you dropping some jewels. But, yeah, I was going to say, I know Bianca had something she wanted to say. But thank you. Everything you're saying is very dope and very needed. So thank you. Go ahead, Bianca. Yeah.
Well, I do have a question, but I do also want to say is once we get Anani on the line and have him speak a little bit, I want to bring that back up because I believe his opinion on the matter will be a great open discussion. So the last 30 minutes, I kind of want to open it up for all of us to talk. But before we do bring him in, I do want to ask, so what is Stokely going to be coming back around for people maybe in the D.C. Baltimore area to view? And also, if not, what projects do you have coming up next? Because I know I'm excited really to see you in anything. So let us know what you got, man.
Well, right now we're working on Howard University. And anybody that's listening that attends Howard University, I strongly recommend you all, you know, blow up their student life office to get them to get us over there. It would be a big shame to not have this show at Howard University, the place where the man graduated. The place where he was really motivated and became part of the civil rights movement. The place where he joined NAG and the NCC, SNCC. I mean, it would be a shame. You know, we got other places looking at us that are not in the area, the DMV area. But one of the places that we definitely got to bring it is Howard. So, you know, either y'all or any of the listeners, blow up, you know, look for them online, the Student Life Activities Office. Blow them up. And tell them, hey, we need Stokely Power, Stokely Carmichael over here at the school. There's an individual down in Richmond, Virginia. We're in talking about bringing the show there. Theater down in Miami, Florida in April. We're looking to come down there, and we're looking to take the show to New York and to London for about 3 or 4 dates over there. So, and possibly
awesome.
Even California. Yeah. Yeah.
Also,
so everything is to be determined.
Posted. Yes, yes, keep
ma'am.
Us posted so we can post it to our listeners and also shout it out on here, because I know it's something that everyone really should see. As you said, a lot of people are not familiar with Stokely Carmichael, black and white, or they're familiar with his face and not his name. But we around here yelling black power, black power, black power, and he's one of the men that have helped to coin that term and make it as popular as it is today. So I'm going to go ahead and let Shalice intro in our next amazing guest. And Michonne, thank you very much. And we're going to loop you back in shortly. So if you don't
thank
mind,
you.
Stay on the line. We would love to hear more from you.
Yes, ma'am.
Perfect. Go ahead, Shalice.
Okay. So our next guest is someone that I have had the pleasure of connecting with through kind of finding my own path as a black woman, you know, educating myself. He happens to be my instructor. I do attend PLM, African Awareness and Critical Thinking study classes on Sundays, and he is the instructor for the beginning class. He also has an upcoming lecture, The Harmful Effects of White Supremacy. So I'm going to let him you know, take it away from here, introduce yourself, and tell us more about this upcoming lecture that he has. So I present to you Anani Fatua.
Thank you. Thank you, sister. Thank you. Thank you for allowing me in. Fatiu. Fatiu.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Fatiu.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's okay. Oh, man, it's a beautiful pleasure to be a part of this. Tell you a little bit about myself. Thank you. I started coming around PLM, which stands for the Pan-African Liberation Movement, around 2008. I came in very ambitious, wanting to learn my history and culture, and I found my path, like most people find their path sometimes, is when you find yourself hurt, you know, and everything else that you once went to is just not making sense anymore. And I realized that's because I never had a sense of self, a knowledge of who I am as an African man, a part of an African family. So I started coming around in 2008. I grabbed a couple books, and I believed I was going to be a master teacher in 2 days. You know, I thought I was just going to be super African. And it took me quite some time, you know, and it allowed me to really evolve, and it transformed my life in an amazing way. And the name Anani Kulu Fatu was a name that I had earned through the demonstration of hard work and dedication and love for our people. So I really, you know, feel, as the brother said, once you lose your slave name and you're allowed to really embrace an African name and you carry that name, and it was bestowed upon you through eldership, which it came through me, through my organization that I'm a part of. I love PLM. I became a facilitator of the beginner study class. So that's an honor in itself to be able to guide people and help people answer those tough questions of what about, well, I learned this all my life, and how do I deal with that conflict and that clash, you know? Like, man, I've been taught that Christopher Columbus discovered America. And then when I put you down and let you know that he is the most wickedest white man you can ever think of, you know, it's like a culture shock, because you realize that you're outside of your culture. I've been a part of PLM, like I said, since 2008, and on all of their endeavors, we do a Kwanzaa celebration, we do a marketplace. I mean, these things are annual, consistently going on. Pan-African Day of Solidarity, the Pan-African Symposium, Stop the Violence Block Parties. I'm very active in teaching the youth. I am also a co-facilitator of the Urban Youth Initiative Project since 2009. I've worked in Utah Marsh Grant Elementary School. I'm also a member and a worker of the New Vision Youth Services, where we help deal with the social and emotional components of our children, you know, because a lot of people don't want to talk about it, but in these school systems, you can't teach a child not one damn thing if their emotions and their social situation is not conducive for them to receive the information that they need. And it was a great program put forth by the brother Imhotep, and he realized that these children need these new life skills. They need these things to allow them to adapt in this society and allow them to appreciate what it is that they're learning so that they can know that they are future liberators and change makers of their community. Contributed to Brother Imhotep's books, both his books, Urban Philosophy Series, the introduction the foreword, rather, in the Thought and Behavior System, and the introduction in his book, Urban Philosophy, Politics of Urban Struggle. I've done two lectures so far, you know, that's been done publicly. I've done in-house lectures. I've done two lectures thus far, the Resurgence of African Youth in the 21st Century. That's my second lecture, Identifying the Ancestor Within, Who Are You? So as I heard the Baba speaking, I was really like, okay, I'm vibing, because the Bible was hitting on right where a lot of things that I speak about and deal with. And then my newest lecture, as you mentioned, The Harmful Effects of White Supremacy. Oof, that one right there. It's going to be so much fun, and it's going to be so rewarding, and it's going to be very important to everyone. Everyone has to hear that, because we don't know, and the Bible was hitting on it, man. He was like giving me the assist. You know, I'm going to be Stephen Curry. I'm going to shoot this thing in a basket, man. I'm going to make this point, because we don't really understand the harmful effects of white supremacy. We just lost a great giant, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, and she speaks about it.
Yeah.
She's echoed that in her book. We do not understand white supremacy at all, and we do not understand the harmful effects. Lastly, you know, I'm from Baltimore. I've been here all my life. You know, maybe you can hear it in my vernacular or how I speak. I'm from Park Heights, which is like his own island in Baltimore. You know, I'm the oldest of a teenage mother. You know, my mother had me at 15. So, you know, I've been through my own transformative processes. And the only thing that saved me, the only thing that put me on this path to be able to even speak to you all, was PLM and them giving me the tools of learning about my history and my culture. Like, when you know who you are as a black person, it's amazing, and what it does to you and how it unlocks you and how your esteem is just risen through the roof, and there's nothing that can stop you after that, and you become a change maker for your community and for your people. It's amazing. I'm a father of two dynamic daughters, you know what I'm saying, Kayla and Zaire, my babies. I love them. And the another unique complexity to me is my father is unknown. I've never known my father ever. I'm going to be 32 this year. And walking around with that and still being able to, you know, try to function was a major obstacle in my life. But it allowed me to put some things in focus and made me become more of a dynamic father. But it's still a void that plagues me to this day, because, you know, it's not having that completion of yourself. And that is what white supremacy does. It breaks down the family. It breaks down the community. Everybody's at odds with each other and ready to, like the Baba said, everybody's ready to destroy each other to take their eyes off the oppressor. One of the greatest analogies we can use is we focusing on Pinocchio while Geppetto is just sitting up there just moving the strings, and nobody's focusing on the puppet master. They're focusing on the puppets, and we got to get into this. We got to really, really get into what white supremacy is doing to us all the way across the board. There's no stone unturned. There's no way you can come through this society, specifically this society, this current society we live in, and not be impacted by white supremacy. If you come to me and you tell me, oh, not me, I've got my degrees, I've got my car, I've got my house, I'm looking like, damn, white supremacy is efficient with you. If I look at, you know, you and you say, nah, man, you know, we got to get money, white supremacy is working well with you. If I'm looking at you and you say, man, I don't need no woman, I like being a bachelor, white supremacy is working well with you. I ain't no God, white supremacy is working well with you. You know what I'm saying? I can just prove in every aspect of how white supremacy is destroying the fabric of people that are African and non-European. White supremacy is destroying us, and we refuse to deal with it. We refuse to talk about it and face it head on. I heard you guys mentioning some music earlier, and you were also speaking about some movies. See, all of that, to me, it's once again white supremacy. You know what I'm saying? I don't give a damn about none of them awards. I don't even like to even talk about them. To more than to know what they are doing to perpetrate and destroy our community. That's the only time we need to talk about them. Everything else is about healing and pushing us to a place where we become free, we become liberatory, we become decision makers, and in Kuji Chakalia we have self-determination. We're talking about everything but what's important, you know. So that's just a little bit of, you know, myself and what I'm a part of, and I love everything that I'm a part of, man. I don't question it. I don't go against it, because it gives me this opportunity to speak coherently and clear to you right now. You know what I mean?
Okay. Well, I got something for you.
All right. Jump at me. Shoot at me.
You cover white supremacy from every aspect, right?
Yeah, every aspect.
Okay. So white supremacy and relationships. Go.
Okay. White supremacy and relationships. You have effeminized the man and his role, and you have masculinized the woman and her role. And how white supremacy works is it keeps these people at odds. It breaks them apart. It doesn't allow them to see their union should be maximized to develop the family, to develop the community, to develop the nation. But no, I will make the black man have an inferior job or an inferior position, and I will take the black woman and I will rise her over them to keep them distracted, not knowing that if we look at each other and we say, hey, let's maximize this for our benefit. No, they will destroy it. They will pull that apart because the woman is disappointed because she has to work excessive hours and bring in money, and he's not meeting ends meet because they don't understand that she makes $100,000 and he makes $20,000. They don't see it as $120,000. They see it as, this is my $100,000. That's your $20,000. And it breaks the relationship up. What does that do? It breaks the family up. It breaks the family up. It breaks the community up. And it allows both of them to be puppets for white supremacy in order to destroy each other in many different ways. And the woman says, well, punk, ain't no good black man. And a man say, a woman ain't nothing but a hoe. And then before you know it, here we go. You know, that's just one of the tactics of how white supremacy finds its way in and erodes a family, because they don't, you see the power in culture. They don't know that if they have that African history and culture, the black man can never feel insecure for a black woman doing what she has to do. And a black woman can never look at her man as a person that don't provide, when he is the strength and the power behind not only the protection of the family, but the appearance of the family. And she honors that. See, when you know your history and your culture, there is no divisiveness. But white supremacy, when we get distracted and all the other things, it works and it erodes the family. It erodes the relationship. It has them reaching for outside forces outside of their culture and their community to heal them, which is ultimately what? To pull them further apart, to let them know that they can't find solace and peace with each other, but the action and within their elders and their community. Nah, they don't do that. They don't look at the long-standing relationships of 40 years and 20 years. And granted, yeah, we don't see that today. That's because white supremacy has been effective. But there was a time where you can go to a couple that was together for 40 years and you ask them, how did you do it? Yeah, right now they sleep in separate rooms, but they live in the same house. So you ask them, how did you do it? How did you get this far? You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. you show that you get that lesson and that wisdom. See, white supremacy says, no, go out here and get counseling from a quote-unquote person with degrees, degrees, book knowledge, when it's that empirical knowledge of that family, that was that couple that was together that pulled and ate, while the husband ate half of the chicken or a quarter of the chicken, and he had to divide it between the family, and the wife said, you know what, I'm just going to eat this drumstick. He ate the thighs, he ate the drumstick, and the children had to eat the rest. That's a family working together. That's white supremacy not being defeated, rather, showing that the family doesn't look at their situation as a dire one, but a one to bring more closeness and bonding together. I hope I answered your question.
Okay, you did. You went off real quick.
I've been waiting. I'm sorry. I've been waiting.
So let me build on that real quick. Let me build on that. Because when you speak of manhood, you know, the responsibility of a man is to, above anything, my belief is to protect the black woman and the black child. So what is it that, and something out here is lapsing. I know that I've seen recently a young woman, she was, I think, killed, shot in her head, because she told a brother that she didn't want to give him her phone number. So when we're talking about interpersonal relationships between, you know, melanoid people, what is the responsibility that our men have right now at this time?
My Baba, he say this. He say this quote, right? It's real. It's real beautiful. He say, "Boys run amok when black men don't stand up." And I thought about that, and it shook the very core of me that before we can judge the actions of a male, we got to understand, do they understand that they are men or a man? Because we can't look at the actions of a male, an adult male, and say that that's a man, because a man has knowledge of self and knows how to conduct oneself. So when we make the delineation between a male, an adult-sized male, and a man, we got to realize that something's going on. The community of men need to start sitting down and having discussions about how to rear our young black males and bring them through the proper rites of passage into manhood. And then when we do that, we are forever a resource, and we are forever utilized in their lives to help them not make those misguided decisions. You know what I'm saying? I'm not justifying what is done, and I'm not really saying that, you know, I'm asking for necessarily mercy of what he's done. But what I see is what my Bob always told me, you understand, that boys run amok when black men don't stand up. If he knew that he had to answer to strong, serious black men that had knowledge of self and knew who they were, his decisions, not only would his conscience halt him from making such a violent decision, but the recourse and the issues of how he would be penalized would be even another hindrance to hold him back. And if that young lady didn't decide to talk to him, then he would say, you know, well, okay, she's not the one. So I think that, you know, when we look at what that large adult male did, we got to realize he wasn't a man. And that's where we got a lot of large adult males running around, because men are not in the community as much, or not going through the proper rites of passage to get into manhood and then fulfill the role of a man in the community.
Agreed, 100%.
So I just got to say this to my brother. I fucked with you so hard after that. And you know what I mean. Like, that was... that was powerful. So the harmful effects of white supremacy... Give us your definition of what is white supremacy. The definitions, depending on who you talk to, they vary. And we had broached this subject on our show before, but we just want to lead into your lecture. You know, what is white supremacy?
Well, how I would define white supremacy is a complete and total system that is for the upliftment of all people's white and all people that subscribe to white domination, and it is the exploitation and the oppression and the repression of all non-European people, period. And that's just to make it succinct. I think that sometimes we can make it, you know, very detailed and very complex, because it is. But for this sake of this discussion, it is the upliftment and the rise of all European people and everybody that subscribe to white supremacy and its system in itself of racism and exploitation and domination and the suppression and repression of all non-European people, and however that is manifested, however it is, you know, expressed, it shows through white supremacy as a system. It is a complete and total system, and it is a very effective system. It covers racism, it covers economics, it covers politics, it covers religion, it has its own system all the way across the board. And I like to always, when I explain what white supremacy is, I think that we also have to give a counter to white supremacy, which is Pan-Africanism, which is another complete system to push back and put things in its rightful order. So where there's exploitation, there's non-exploitation in Pan-Africanism. Where there's repression, there's liberation.
and Pan-Africanism. So I kind of always want to throw that out there, too, if I was able to give a clear definition, just for sake of time.
I want you to build
on
that. Yeah, I want you to build on that, because a lot of people like me, I myself, I do identify as a Pan-Africanist.
Right.
But a lot of people do not really know what that term fully means. So can you go into that for us?
Well, you know, Pan-Africanism clearly is pan meaning all, and Africanism meaning embracing all of African cultural norms, ethics, morals. But Brother Imhotep has added to that, and he calls new for this time. He calls it scientific Pan-Africanism. And scientific Pan-Africanism, now we're getting a little deeper. Now we're going, you know, the old former Pan-Africanists, they were very great in their pioneering efforts to give us a sense of going back home and making the repatriation, whether it be physical, mental, spiritual. They gave us that, but they still had some compromising things going on in their life. Whereas those scientific Pan-Africanism says, oh, no, we got to cut all that off. It's got to be African cultural norms and precepts all the way through. And I'm talking about antiquity Africa. I'm talking about prior to any invasion, authentic and antiquity, where no invasions, no foreign influences. We had to deal with our own, the way we dealt with them, and the way that it thrived as great nations, as great empires, as a great state, as a great people that risen in every feat that you can think of. That means we got to go back, and scientific Pan-Africanism, we got to look at everything, take the best from everybody, and condense it, push it in, and give it to our new, this new African, because this is a new African.
Mm-hmm.
We've been through so much as a new African. We need something new, and Brother Imhotep, man, he is a complete visionary, you know, and that's in his book, Urban Philosophy, Thought, and Behavior. And when I seen that, it immediately resonated with me. It immediately hit me like, damn, you're right. You know what I'm saying? We got to take the best from everybody. We can't argue about what Martin did or what Malcolm did or what Garvey did or what Du Bois did or what Fanon did. We can't argue about, well, one was still a Christian and one was still a Muslim and one subscribed to Marxism, one subscribed to socialism. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we can't even get caught up in all of that. We got to take the best from them because they used what they had at that time. But now we got to take the best from them and push it all together, and then we got to start trimming the fat off. We got to get rid of some of them old practices, some of them things that we once partake in that have had foreign influence. We got to trim that stuff off, and we got to go right to the core of who we were as people that put us in this great feat. And that's the only way, and I say this, and whoever here, you can challenge me, the only way that the world will get right. When African people take their rightful seat, the world will get right. All of this destruction and all these wars and all this illnesses and things that go on and continue will dramatically change when the African gets in their rightful seat on that throne as the head of the world in order to guide everybody and watch their children do as they do today. I think that's what Pan-Africanism is to me, and that's how I see it.
Yeah, and to kind of, for me, to piggyback off of that, and I've said this before, is I think the knowledge of self is empowering in itself. And right now, and so many people don't know where they come from. So even with Michonne talking to you, and we're just talking about our last name, it has so much power. So, you know, Shalisa and I talk a lot. For me, I feel very lucky because my mom is Turkish, but her parents are from Sudan and Ethiopia. So I know my roots. I have pictures of my roots. I know where my people come from. On the other hand, I have my dad, who's from South Carolina, and all I know is the last name Bynes, which is rooted to British people with the last name Bynes, and that's all I know. But for me, just researching about my mom's side and knowing that I literally come from royalty, and Shalisa and I laugh about this all the time, but when I tell you I am royalty and the air that I breathe is royal, I say that because I know it to believe is true. And that's a lot for all of us, whether it's royalty in your tribe, royalty to your family, whatever the case may be, the self-knowledge will give you power to go there. But we've been stripped so much by white supremacy, which goes along with what this brother here is talking about, that we don't have that, and people are grasping for that. Everyone is, I'm not African, I'm American. What the fuck does that mean? Like, at this point in time, I don't know why anyone would be even proud to say that shit when you come from a continent that has given us so much that you're so quick to disregard it, but we have been brainwashed to feel that way, to even hate the Africans that are here that come from Africa. So I think it's a self-conditioning and a self-training that we have to do, and I appreciate, you know, brothers like you that are really getting out here and preaching the message, and not just on Facebook or, you know, in Instagram, like giving lectures and teaching to the youth and to really anyone that's able to learn, because you're never too old to do that. So I just want to say thank you for that.
I mean, just to speak to that real quick, you know, like you said, the knowledge of self, you know, I tell people in my family this all the time, and they're my elders, and they are shocked by, you know, the fact that I tell them that I draw strength from the fact that I know so much about my family history, that I know that I come from, I feel like a queen, you know. I didn't come from royalty per se, but I come from a family of hard workers. I come from a tight-knit, close family that has always taken care of its own, and that empowers me. So I just said that to say that, you know, when you are learning your history, learn your history too. This is something that, you know, Anani and I, we just spoke to this today, earlier, when we said that, you know, when you talk about your ancestors, yes, we have Malcolm and we have Martin, we have Rosa, we have Coretta, we have Fanny, we have Kwame. We have amazing ancestors who have paved the way for us all. But we also have them within our own families, within our own bloodline.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Your ancestors, they speak to you every day. Every time that you reflect on that grandmother who, you know, gave you that loving, or that aunt or that uncle who's not here with you anymore, that always guided you along the way, that is an ancestor speaking to you in some kind of way, and we have to learn how to, you know, open those connections up again. I know that something that Imhotep said that spoke to me was to find my ancestor in history. And it was profound that he said that during my first class, because anyone who knows me knows that the loss of my mother when I was 18 had a profound effect on my life. And for him to say, you know, I want you guys as an assignment to find yourself, find your mother, find your father in history. If you don't have a mother, find her in history. Look for her. She's there. The ancestor that will speak to your experience, she is there. And the same for fathers. You know, we mourn so much over the loss of mothers and fathers in our community. It's trauma that's been passed down. But we have to learn how to, you know, build that bridge to our spiritual self. And I know that's something, I know that you have, you know, spoken to that before. And I know that, you know, that's something that you identify with as well, Anani.
Yeah, you know, briefly, you know, I think that, I think that's a crime for us to reveal all of these things outside of ourselves. You know, I think that the rightful people that deserve their acknowledgement, we should praise them. We should praise Marcus Garvey. We should praise Drusilla Dungy Houston. We should praise all the great hard workers. But it was your grandmother. It was that great grandmother that refused to capitulate, that refused, even under the most hellish conditions, to allow you to be here to even read their works, to listen to their lectures, to do anything of that nature. If you got to go and dig deep on that. You got this big mural of what you say you believe in, but you wouldn't even believe in any of that if it wasn't for your grandmother and your grandfather. You wouldn't even know what that is. So while you got this big picture of whoever you say you believe in, you better have an equally big picture right next to him, because it was that person that led you that way. It was that person that prayed for you. It was that person that interceded and intervened for you that you even don't even have any clue. Some of us are texting and driving, knowing we shouldn't be doing it, you know, but we just doing it. And before you know it, you swerve out of an accident. You think you did that?
You really believe that you did that, that you caught up and you lift your head at the right time? Or was it that ancestor, that direct ancestor, whether it be old or young, said, lift your damn head up and stop doing what you're doing. Get home safe because you have a purpose. Mamba Ani teaches us that we chose to come here as African people. We chose it. So anybody that's black chose it in the ancestral realm. And through the process, it's for you to come into a situation where it reminds you of the decision that you chose. And every time you look in that mirror, you chose to be here. So you better damn sure approve and love and have complete murals and shrines for the ones who made their transition in your life, because they talking to you and they there for you and they getting you out of some of the most complex situations. Malcolm and them are inspiring you, no doubt, as your grandmother in the sky.
Okay, so you know, I feel all of that, and I speak to that a lot, just based off of, like I said, my own experiences. So I thank you for that. We're going to take some callers. Now, let's explain, before we take the callers, let's explain how the calling thing goes. If you pressed 1 when you called in, that means that we can see your number, and we're going to bring you on the line. I'm going to say the first 6 numbers of your phone number, including your area code. And if you have something to say, then you can go ahead and shout us out. You can ask a question, say whatever you want, make your comment. If you don't want to speak, then just say, I'm just listening. Okay? So let's start with the first caller. The first caller is going to be 862-202. Are you there? 862-202. Okay. Let's take the next caller. Okay. 203-570. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Welcome to the show. Peace, Bravo. What's going on?
Peace. I'm just enjoying the dialogue, man. I didn't expect all this. I'm just appreciative to be here, but I'm going to go back and listen. I ain't got nothing to say. Just appreciate the guest.
Thank you so much.
Thank
for calling
you in. So much.
Okay. The next caller is going to be 443-683.
Okay. 443-683-9900.
Are you there?
No.
All right, let's go to the last one.
Okay. And the last caller is 302-407. Are you there? Caller, are you there? Okay. And there we go. And that's all the calls.
Right. And just to piggyback off of what Shalee said earlier, guys, you can listen without pressing 1. So if you don't want to talk, you don't have to call in the number. You can also catch us on the blogtalkradio.com/YBE, where you can listen to it live. Or you don't have to press 1 to raise your hand, or else we think you have something to say. And also, if you don't want to talk, you can please feel free to put it in the chat. And we'll be happy to read the question up on there if you're shy or whatever the case may be. So I know we do have 10 minutes left. I did want to bring Michonne back in and Anuni so we can kind of have an open discussion. It's been really good for me, and I've really enjoyed having this. So I kind of want to bring Michonne back in and kind of engage your thoughts on the last 20 minutes. I know you've been sitting there quietly, so I know you probably have some things you want to say about what we've been talking about, and you guys can kind of also go back and forth and kind of toss some ideas and stuff around. So what you think, Michonne?
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Okay. Great. No, I just think that the brother is just—he's just right on the money with everything that he was saying there. And we, then that's the type of mind that we need out here in the community right now, and we need more of that. We need our brothers out here so hungry and passionate for the truth and for planting those seeds, you know, out there, because the people are dying for it. One thing I love that he said is that, you know, it's true. I believe his brother had said it. He said, you know, I'm paraphrasing, that when the children run amok, when the men don't stand up or step up, that's true. That right there is, I mean, that's one of the biggest issues that we're having, is that you know, you have these young men out here, no guidance at all, just wild weeds growing up among us, and just causing havoc and causing destruction. And every single time one little girl gets shot or one little boy gets shot or, you know, some tragedy happens in the neighborhood, all the people that you see standing there around the cameras, you know, around the microphones, all these sisters. And I'm like, well, where are all the men? Where are they? I mean, you know, I mean, where are the men? They're saying, no, don't worry. We've already solved the crime. We got the perpetrators right over here. Yeah, y'all, you know what I mean? Y'all might as well just turn those cameras off. We got them right here. You know what I mean? Once upon a time, we had that type of community where you could not be caught out there doing anything halfway, because by the time you got home, the whole neighborhood had got a hold of it. And then when you got home, that's when mom and daddy really, you know, they went all in on you, as they say. Mm-hmm. You know, but we've completely lost that as a people. We've always been about our tribe. We've always been about the proper order of things in our community. You know, when it comes to the elders, you know, when it came to the young people, there was a meme that somebody was putting out there showing all these old ladies, you know what I mean, in front of a church, and basically they were saying, like, this was our police right here. You know what I mean? And I remember that growing up, you know, in my father's church, those were the people that kept you in line, all those elders. Now, you know, where are the elders? Few and far between, you know, specifically the men. Where are they? That we have to be there to help guide these children. Now, you know, I remember I was talking to this one brother, you know, he was like, well, you know, it's me and his mama, you know, she's doing this and she's using the children as pawns or whatever, stuff like that. And all these different excuses, and I hear that. And it's very frustrating, because some of these sisters, not all, some of them, to get back at the man, will try to use those children as pawns, and then they know they can do that because they got the system behind them to back them up, to jam him up or to put him in jail or to garnish his check for more child support, you know what I mean, even though he's paying an exorbitant amount or whatnot. But see, that's when, and it goes back to what the brother is talking about here, having that knowledge of self, because once you have that knowledge of self, you know who you are, and then you have this courage that rises up in you. And so none of these things that the white supremacists put before you, you don't even blink an eye at them. You know what I mean? And you're willing to die. You're willing to go all out. And that has been lost when it comes to us and our children. We're forgetting what they are. That's not just some baby you had. That is your life. That is your future. Those children are the keys to eternity, because they continue. They further your existence. Especially for the black man and woman.
okay, because you don't have a birth record. I mean, you know, they keep going back and going back and going back. 1 million, 2 million, 3 million, 4 million. So keep finding you. So you are the alpha. You're the omega. You don't have a beginning because you don't have an ending. So I'm gonna let some fool who mad because we broke up keep me from being near me. See, that's when, as men, that's when you have to stand up and say, okay, well, that's going to happen. So now I don't know what you're going to try to do, but this is going to happen. This relationship is going to happen. And you need to be willing to go to the length, all the way, to make that happen, including death. See, now, we see people say, oh, what you mean you're going to kill? No, it's not about killing nobody. It's about standing up like men. Standing up like men, what the brother's doing. I do the same thing over at McKinley Tech. Mentor and work with some of these young brothers. You know what I mean? I was doing that in Miami. It was so good to hear another brother doing that. And I love the passion that the brother has, because that's what's needed to instill in these young men what it means to be men. And we got too much of this moist behavior going on. Okay, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful, but we got too much of this moist, tight jean sagging mentality, and grown folks talking about, well, ain't nothing wrong with that. Specifically, some of our sisters. Now, I'm just calling it for what I see. And the sisters are saying that because they're the ones that are in charge, because we as the men have failed to take our proper place. Brother was talking about taking our proper place as black people. Well, before that can happen, the black man has to take his proper place. And we just sit around. Well, you see us. You see us on the corner, sitting there with our head down. You say, hey, brother. What? I didn't hear you. What'd you say? Nah. See, that's a god that has just fallen all the way down in the mud, and he's no different than the damn swine trying to eat the husks out of the trough. So what brother is sitting here talking about, that is so essential. That is so essential. That is the key. You know, stand up and be men, brothers. Be men. Sisters are disrespecting us because we failed to be men, right or wrong.
Yeah.
See, that was
correct.
The
and
man,
I hate
grandmama.
To, I'm sorry.
I see, because you get me started.
Yeah,
I see. He's on it.
I just want to mention my lecture that's coming up February 6th, 2016, at 7 p.m. Doors open up at 6 p.m. It's a free event. Dinners will be sold. My topic, again, is the harmful effects of white supremacy. I need everybody to come out and bring somebody, bring three people, make this place be super packed. And then the very next day, we got an elder, a dynamic elder, as he said, the elder, Baba Kamau Cambone. See, I'm talking about the harmful effects. He's going to talk about dismantling white dominance and restoring that to mind. And that's $20. That's $20. You got to get your tickets. The flyers are circulating. It's floating around. I'm going to give more to the queen, my sister that made sure I was able to do this. We got to get out there. We got to get out there. I got a Periscope. Champion for Africa is my Periscope. My Facebook page is Anani Kulu Fatu. I do Facebook Live on there, and I give out information. And when I say champion for Africa, that's because that's what I see myself as, a champion for Africa, a person that's willing to fight the fight no matter what, you know, and no matter against all odds and obstacles, you know. So I just please be there, bring somebody, make sure we don't have a seat left for nobody. Make us have to change the venue because everybody say they coming. If you got some concerns, if you got some ills, you got some ways on how you feel, I'm going to give you the best message I can possibly give you. Please come. The location is 3939 Reichstown Road, Baltimore, Maryland, 21215. Again, 3939 Reichstown Road, Baltimore, Maryland, 21215.
Come on out.
All right, and we'll post that on the page this evening. Yeah. I hate to cut you off, but the show is about to end, y'all, so we appreciate y'all so much. Thank you so very much, you guys, and we'll post
all of
this on the line.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Appreciate
it.
Thank you, y'all.
Black Power. Good night.
Hotel.
Black Power.